Hello, and welcome to the Morbid Anatomy Transmission. I'm your host, Molly McBride Jacobson. In this episode, I'm talking with social psychologist Michael Johns, whose event, Experimenting with Death, an introduction to the terror management theory of human behavior, is taking place at the Morbid Anatomy Museum in Brooklyn on March 18th. If, much like me, you have no idea what terror management theory is, you're going to want to keep listening.
Is terror management theory?
I'll frame it this way because I think it's helpful. It was developed based on the writings of Ernest Becker, and it fundamentally is, you know, sort of designed and intended to help understand why it is that we tend to, as human beings, have such a hard time getting along with each other, you know, at sort of the group level. So, you know, why we see such long histories of war and intergroup conflict. And then the other piece to that that is not so obvious but is even more interesting is, you know, why it is that humans tend to have this need to have a sense of self-esteem, feel good about ourselves, feel that we're valuable, meaningful members of a larger culture, a larger system. And so the theory, essentially drawing on Becker's ideas, basically pointed out that humans are pretty unique among animals. We are extremely intelligent. We have a pretty large brain proportionally to our body. We have, and in particular, you know, we have this very large frontal lobe and neocortex that allows us to, you know, some unique abilities. One of those being just the capacity to understand the nature of time in a different way. I mean, we can understand the past, but we can think abstractly, which allows us to think forward and imagine sort of different possibilities for the future. And along with that comes the ability to be aware of our own existence and to be aware of the fact that we exist now in a particular time, but we understand that, you know, into the future, as our individual selves, our corporeal selves, won't exist eventually. And our ability to conceptualize this sense of self, this sense of identity, makes that awareness very unpleasant and uncomfortable. Because we're also animals, you know, we have a tendency and a basic drive not to die. The basic idea is that, you know, we're stuck in this uncomfortable situation of being alive, not wanting to die, but knowing that that's going to happen. What the theory suggests is that if we were constantly aware of that, thinking about it consciously, it would create the potential for paralyzing terror. Because all you would be worried about is the fact that, you know, the world is a dangerous place, and we see it every day, especially now in sort of modern, you know, media landscape. But, you know, you think about even before you had television, newspapers, and all of that, life was short and very hard. So to be able to sort of live and thrive in the face of, you know, the impermanence of life, what the theory suggests is that we developed culture, essentially. We used the same capacity we have for abstract thinking, and we create a worldview, which is essentially a value system that explains what it takes to be a valuable member of a group. And within that value system, we then have a set of rules for knowing how to achieve self-esteem. And so it's through, you know, culture that provides an explanation, oftentimes, for why we're here, how to be a valuable person, how to achieve a sense of meaning and purpose that allows us to sort of live in the face of our knowledge of our own mortality. But at the heart of the theory, I think, and where it gets interesting is to understand that what a worldview is and how it operates, and that is they're consensual belief systems, right? And a worldview is only as good as you can get other people to see the world the way you see it and have the same beliefs you have. And what that means is that if there is another person or other people that have different worldviews, that's very threatening, right? Because that might suggest your worldview isn't the right worldview or the best worldview. There might be other ways of seeing and developing value. And so that creates, because we need that worldview to be able to achieve a sense of self-esteem and keep sort of our fear, our potential for terror at bay, that creates the sort of potential then to, for intergroup conflict.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that because I think New York is an interesting case because it's the Woody Allen syndrome, you know? People here are classically anxious.
That's right.
Do you think that's because of the cross-cultural paths, or...
I don't know. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, the sort of neurotic New Yorker stereotype is a fascinating stereotype, and just getting your basic needs met here can be very difficult because of the number of people that are in this space with you. There's also the sort of varieties of ways of living and thinking that then sort of maybe compound that general sort of competitive culture that is really prominent here. There's some research that's been done by a colleague of mine, someone I knew in grad school, Jamie Goldenberg, looking at the impact of neuroticism in reactions to sort of reminders of death, and there's definitely a connection there where proneness to neuroticism sort of in a sense you can conceptualize it as being, having those thoughts of death, those concerns,
closer to the surface.
That's right.
Well,
yeah. And that's kind of, and it's functional, right? But taken too far, obviously, it can become dysfunctional.
So how much of our daily behavior would you say is influenced by us managing our terror?
One of the things that's both very useful and powerful about the theory, although a source of some argument within academic circles, is that I think you could make the case that a lot of our just day-to-day mundane behavior has a connection to those concerns about our mortality and the need to keep that sort of existential concern at bay to be able to function properly. To the degree that, self-esteem is the desire for self-esteem, the need to feel like you're a valuable, meaningful individual in a larger sort of world, drives us to go to school and get a bachelor's degree or an advanced degree, or to, learn about a theory and then go give a talk about it at a local venue, and to the degree that that makes you feel like you're a valuable and intelligent person, then absolutely, you can make that connection back to those basic concerns. Those are all just very general broad strokes. In terms of thinking about, the research, a lot of it has been focused on understanding the particular implications for the ways we might tend to view members of other groups negatively, how those feelings might lead us to act negatively towards them, such as applying stereotypes or even being aggressive. But there's been research looking at, making a connection between concerns about mortality and creativity and concerns about mortality and ability to sort of experience pleasure from or, develop rules around sex, for example. Some terror management research looks at that through the lens of mortality salience, as it's called, and, definitely finds evidence that there's potentially a thread there that is driven by this higher need to sort of think that the world is not just a random, chaotic, uncaring, dangerous place. You think about anxiety disorders and depression, a lot of it is an inability to sort of put those basic immediate thoughts out of mind that become so disruptive. The same cognitive abilities that allow us to think symbolically and abstractly that create this potential for terror that our awareness of mortality creates also allows us to create symbols and cultural meaning as well. So it's sort of this turning a weakness into a strength kind of idea, which is interesting as well.
With that in mind, what do we make of people who are what we might call underachievers? People who don't attempt to meet the cultural norms.
So it's interesting, and I think one point that's important to really make and clarify is that, from the theory's perspective, we each have our own sort of individualized version of the worldview. And obviously within the broader culture, there are subcultures and groups of people that, develop their own meaning systems that might be directly at odds with the larger meaning system. So it's not a matter of there being a sort of right or wrong model, but that idea that there's even another underachiever is sort of one worldview commenting on another. Subscribing to a meaning system that is at odds with the larger group is extremely difficult and painful. One of the ideas that was motivated these studies looking at the relationship between mortality salience and creativity was sort of loosely trying to understand, the idea of the tortured artist. And in a lot of ways, you know, artists are very interesting because to be creative and to really be innovative, you have to sort of reject or almost live outside of the dominant system to really to move it in a different direction, and that can be extremely hard. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't think the theory really has any doesn't make a sort of judgment about who does well and who does poorly. I think it says more about why we make those distinctions in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that's the framework for understanding why we would have this idea of, you know, success and the way it's defined and what, how we would evaluate someone as being successful or not, and how someone would evaluate themselves, right? And because that's ultimately what matters. But it's tricky because we are such social beings. We really rely, and we're meaning-making machines. I mean, we rely on others to understand who we are. As much as we might have our own ideas, it's a very... But, you know, it's interesting, and it's an extreme example, but it's always salient to me is, you know, you think about the anecdotal, and there's decent empirical evidence, you know, about the effects of isolation that might occur in, say, solitary confinement. And people literally go crazy, because if you don't have others there, if you don't have any way to sort of connect with other beings, to even just have those shared moments, our minds are really just not set up to handle those sorts of situations. And it's not surprising that people literally lose their minds, you know, when they're in a cell 23 hours a day and maybe outside of it for an hour. And in that hour, they're maybe still just not having any kind of meaningful contact or exchange with others.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because the one thing people say in anthropology all the time is that there's no one outside of culture. You know, if there's a person who is an underachiever and doesn't live up to any of the norms of their culture, they're still existing within it and in reaction to it. But removing someone from culture, as much as you can in solitary confinement, is really
that's right. And there's, you know, there's interesting work. There's a guy, Kip Williams, who's done a lot of really great work on ostracism. There's decent evidence that, you know, when we're ostracized, not only feel sort of psychological, emotional pain, but, you know, those circuits that moderate physical pain in the brain light up as well. And that it really is, you know, a physically painful experience. And there is something to the idea of social death being, you know, an extremely painful and unpleasant situation.
I don't know if this is going outside of your realm of expertise.
This is all outside my realm of expertise, frankly.
What do you know? Whereabouts in history humans became aware of our own mortality, and was that around the same point in time we started developing culture?
I don't think anybody, and I think it ends up being a multidisciplinary question for physical anthropologists and neuropsychologists. The focus up until this point, I think, has been largely on trying to understand, you know, and you would probably know this better than me, you know, sort of when culture emerged. And I think to the degree that, you know, it seems like pretty frequently, you know, new archaeological evidence emerging about showing the fact that, you know, maybe people as far back as humans, as far back as very early Homo sapiens, and now I think there's even some discussions about Neanderthals and the degree to which they were buried with artifacts and talismans and things of that sort, or that they were even tattooed, and the implications that might have for you know, there being a culture, and the degree to which, from the theory, that might suggest there was a definite point, they'd reached the point of sort of being aware of mortality. But, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer, and it's a very fraught question, because, you know, one of the things that often comes up, this question of whether or not awareness of mortality is really unique to humans. And I think in a way that's not quite the right question. It would be hard to argue that animals, mammals in particular, don't have some level of awareness. I mean, they have the same capacity for fear and pain, which, you know, I think are evolutionary adaptations to help a living creature avoid mortal wounds and mortal situations. But my sense would be the way we sort of think about it comparatively across mammals, for example, is brain volume, brain size, brain structure and function. And, you know, I think it would ultimately take a really... It'll be a long time before we accumulate the
neuroscientific evidence around modern humans that then we can go back and apply that to the sort of fossil record, if you will. So, I don't know. That answers the question.
I think it does, and it also it makes me think of the fact that in pop science, we like to look at animals, particularly dolphins or primates, and say, look how much they're like us. And then when we're looking at, you know, Neanderthal burial sites or something like that, the fact that they're buried with artifacts seems to, we like to hear that, and it seems like we like to hear that because it means that there is meaning inherent in our life.
Yeah, and that's the tricky part, right? I mean, we know that humans, modern humans, we have a very strong orientation towards anthropomorphism. You know, there's been some scholars that have argued, that have sort of tried to grapple with this because it's so prevalent, and it's not just our dogs and our cats or other mammals, it's furniture and other, it's inanimate objects that we attribute, you know, human qualities and characteristics to. And we're so social, we see human agency in everything. And so we're so good at it, we can't turn it off. And because of that, it makes it hard for us then to go out and study other animals and really know sort of when we're taking that too far and giving, you know, and I'll be honest, I mean, I say this reluctantly, but, you know, some of the most intense conversations I've had about terror management theory are not with people who don't believe the theory, it's with dog owners who don't believe the idea that humans are the only, you know, animals, only mammals that have a sense of their mortality or have a sense of sort of themselves. Most researchers in the field would agree that, you know, we're making progress, but we are a long way off from really being able to say, this is where the self is in the brain. And, you know, there's some people that would argue that, again, or would even question whether that's the right way to approach this, is to think about, like, where's the self part of the brain and where's the, you know, emotion part of the brain.
Yeah, even the way we study the brain is cultural, which is...
absolutely.
You can't get out of it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, I find it's hard not to see it as a sort of modern phrenology of a sort, frankly. You know, where it's like, oh, we'll put you in the magnet and we'll show you these things and, oh, look, this little part lights up here. But, you know, there's a really great paper some neuroscientists put out basically showing that the methods that are used most prominently to do those studies can actually also make it seem as if a dead salmon is having brain activity. So there's still a long way to go. There's still some problems that need to be worked out.
So your event at the Morbid Anatomy Museum is on March 18th. Mm-hmm. Without giving out too much away, what can people expect out of that?
So what people can expect is a very basic introduction to the ideas of the theory, the structure of the theory, and using clips from the film Flight to Immortality, which is actually a documentary, essentially, on terror management theory, which is pretty brilliant in and of itself. And then just kind of wrapping up and talking about some of the broader implications for events that we are all very much exposed to and aware of now in terms of, you know, global geopolitical fights against terrorism and things of that sort. I think the important idea is to understand that and make it clear how this is a scientific formulation of more general ideas, and particularly we'll delve into a little bit how Greenberg, Pazinski, and Solomon went about solving this problem and developing a method to actually test the key predictions. And that hinges largely on coming up with an experimental means of manipulating awareness of your own mortality. It's a very challenging theory. I mean, and I would argue that by its nature, it should be challenging because it really sort of asks some deeper questions and raises the possibility that maybe a lot of the amazing and horrifying things that we do are simply just born out of our fear of our own death. And that's a little scary by itself to think that, right? And so to have that understanding and you know, the theory is extremely useful and I think hopefully provides also an opportunity to reflect a little bit maybe about the degree to which our daily life and many of our experiences really are tied to one of the most, you know, basic fears we all carry with us. And that, you know, again, I think one of the important implications of the theory is not that it will be impossible to ever do away with prejudice and violence and, you know, genocide. But if we maybe are less caught up in trying to avoid the inevitable, we might be able to be a little happier now in the moment. Death is maybe inevitable, but something that shouldn't rule our lives. And that gaining some awareness of that might be a nice antidote to living a more fulfilling life of equanimity and peacefulness, if it has a word.
Thanks for listening to the Morbid Anatomy Transmission. If you want to know more about what to do with your mortality anxiety, you can attend Experimenting with Death on March 18th. Tickets are available on the museum's website, morbidanatomymuseum.org, where you can also find out about other upcoming events, such as March 21st's Anthropomorphic Mouse Taxidermy class with Divya Ananthurama. According to the event description, the workshop includes both one and two headed mice, so it's really not one to miss. For questions, please email info@morbidanatomy.org. Today's last words come from airplane bomber Albert Guay, who said, "At least I die famous."